Okay, we are recording. Today is Tuesday, April 19th, 2011. This is Brennan Berg at the University of Texas at Austin, and I am interviewing Doris Brown Heritage, of the track and field athlete of the 1968 U.S. Olympic team. Over the phone today, in order to record her experiences and reflections of the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. And Doris, just to start off, can we just get some basic biographical information from you, just as far as where you're from originally, you know, your athletic experiences growing up, and what led you eventually to becoming an elite athlete that went to the Olympics?
Okay, I'm from Gig Harbor, Washington. Is that enough about that?
Oh, sure. Just, like, for instance, what, you know, did you play, like, a lot of sports as a child? Were you already athletic at an early age?
I always enjoyed running. I just ran a lot. I grew up out in the country. Our house was on right on the beach, and we had 25 acres of woods in the back with roads through it. And so we ran on the beach, we ran in the woods, just had a good time. But there weren't really very organized sports in our area. And because it was on a farm, I was kind of expected to spend time working if I had extra energy. And at school, we did have kind of intramurals, but not a lot. So even though I was a hyperactive kid with plenty of energy, I didn't really get into running or anything until I think about the middle of my high school years. I spent one summer working on a playground as an assistant, and the kids were going to a meet at Tacoma, and I was young enough to be in the meet. And so I did the long jump and the longer races, which were like 50 and 75 yards. And there was a man in Tacoma, an elderly gentleman, who had neighbor kids who he thought needed to have a track team because there was nothing for girls in our area at all. Mm-hmm. And so his level of expertise was like feeding us donuts on the starting line. But he started a little track club for women and asked if my folks if I could do it, and they said no. But they finally reconsidered, and you know, they had never heard of anybody doing anything like this, and they said we had plenty of work on the farm, and besides that I was too much of a tomboy, but they decided to let me do it. And so I think this was in, like, about 1958. 1960 was the first year that 800 meters was really run at all. Before that, our long races had been, like, 200 meters, 200 yards. And what was exciting to me was the first meet I was ever in was in Canada, which was only, like, 2 hours from here, but, you know, out of the country. So I really enjoyed it, enjoyed being with some other girls who ran. Our workouts were not anything to talk about. We met after church on Sunday and had a workout, and since I was like the longer runner of the bunch, you know, I did the starts with the spinners, long jumped with the long jumpers, you know, threw the javelin with the javelin throwers, and then when we were done, I ran a hard 400, so that was kind of the workouts. But at home on my own, I continued running, and because of 400 was run some, even though it wasn't in the Olympics at all then. It wasn't in the Olympics till after the 800. I ran down the road as hard as I could, 400 meters, felt pretty sick, ran back as hard as I could, felt pretty sick again, decided I wasn't going to do this anymore. But then after the stomach cramps and all left, the next day I'd go out and do it again. Finally, my mother took me to the doctor, and asked if I warmed up, and I say, huh, what's warm-up? And so then when I started warming up, you know, things were a little bit better. So that was kind of the beginning. In 1960, that was the summer I graduated from high school, several girls on our team were doing pretty well, and I think I had a national record in the 800 and 400 at some time or other. People in our neighborhood raised the money for us to take the train to southern Texas for the Nationals and the Olympic trials. And because I really hadn't run against anybody in my trial race for the 800, after spending 5 days on the train, sitting up because we couldn't afford the other kind of coaches, you know, getting off periodically and running up and down the railroad tracks, we probably weren't real ready for this meet. It was hot down there, and you know, everything was pretty different. So in my race, I tried really hard to win because I had always been winning, running in the second or third lane. And in the back stretch, somebody gave me the elbow in my stomach, and I passed out. I couldn't finish the race. And I just remember people saying, don't touch her. So I got up and kind of finished the race. But this was a national meet. The next week was Olympic trials. And they decided they would let me run, even though it looked like I was a sickly person, because somebody had actually seen this happen and gone on my behalf. So there was a building on the track. This happened behind the building, so it wasn't easy to see that, you know, I had been knocked out. But anyway, at the trials, I was in the top three, so I got to take the bus to Kansas, Emporia, Kansas, to the training camp. And this was all really interesting to me, being from Seattle, being kind of from the Seattle area, but out in the country, where we didn't really have any blacks in our school. I think there was one black girl in my Sunday school class. So segregation was very new to us. And while we were in Corpus Christi, Texas, at Nationals, it was very strange to us that blacks weren't allowed in the restaurant. So our attitude was, if they aren't going in, we aren't either, so we all had takeout. And then on the bus to Kansas, again, because there weren't really any distance races, 800 was the longest, and there was no 400. The team was basically a black team. So bus driver instructed us that we were to sit in the front seats, and we said, no, I think we'll sit in the back seats. And we got off the bus to go into a restaurant. There was only the five of us that were able to go into the restaurant, but there was one girl from New York, Barbara Brown, I think her name was, who had red hair and blue eyes and freckles. So we took her in with us, and we thought it was hilarious because the restaurant people couldn't decide whether she should be in there. So this kind of gives you a picture of a timepiece for 1960. So that was my beginning in track and field. I didn't get to go to the Olympics. It was more a matter of who you knew, who knew you, than how you really did. I won't go into the details of that part of it, but I didn't get to go, so I went to school, went to Seattle Pacific, where I eventually met my coach, Ken Foreman, and he, like Ed Temple in Tennessee, he was willing to start a track club for women because there were no college teams at that time. I was just running with the boys, running way too hard and being hurt most of the time. So he started a club. Our university allowed us to do that. And so that was in 1962. And then I started to improve. And I broke my foot before the 64 Olympics, so I didn't make that team. I think I was fourth in the trial limping around on a broken foot. And then in 68, I finally qualified for the Olympics. So that was kind of my background.
Okay, very interesting. We can go ahead and go on to Mexico City. But what were your accommodations like when you got there? Do you remember, like, the room you were staying in?
Do you want to know anything about our training camp or anything?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, we can go ahead and touch on that if you want to. That's perfectly
okay.
Fine.
Because our Falcon Track Club from Seattle Pacific had a really good cross-country team. In fact, sometimes out of the six girls who went, we had as many as three from our team. And so our club was invited to go to Los Alamos and see if that would be a good place for the training camp because of the altitude.
Sure.
And so I spent the summer there along with a couple other girls from our club, and it was a very good place. The people were very friendly and accommodating, and it turned out to be a great situation. So my coach and Dr. Harmon Brown were the training camp. They helped put the training camp together, and we had the women's Olympic team was able to go after the trials when we qualified up to Los Alamos and train. So I was there all summer, and then the Olympics were pretty late in the year in October, so I was there a long time. And Kenny Moore was the only guy from the men's team who trained there. He was there some. The others were in a different place in New Mexico. But that was a really, really interesting situation for us and a really nice opportunity for those of us on the team to get to know each other, which I think was a really good because when we got to Mexico City, the situation as far as the dormitories and everything was a little strained. The rooms were so small that we were kind of like wall-to-wall beds, and if you wanted to open your suitcase, which you had to pull out from under your bed, you had to move the beds, move somebody else's bed so you could find a way to get your suitcase up on top of your bed. So the rooms were pretty small, but they were adequate. And, you know, since I think everyone in our room, I was with, I can't remember who all was there, Francie Crocker was running the 800. So a couple of us, Lois Drinkwater, a couple of us there. Anyway, you know, we got along really well, but the situation was crowded. Another thing was, that was, I think, the first Olympics that were where there were difficulties, and the village had to be fenced off. Security was a big deal. So we were kind of living in, like we were in prison. And basically what we did was, we'd go out the gate, get on our bus, and go to warm-up or workout or whatever, get on the bus, come back, and we're inside again. And I think we had one opportunity to go down to a shopping area and one opportunity to go to the Pyramids of the Sun and whatnot. And other than that, we were just in that village. So for those of us who were kind of distance-oriented, you know, because 800 wasn't really my event, it was just the longest thing in the Olympics, we didn't have any opportunity to do any over-distance running, because we were either in the bus, on the track, or, you know, we were in our village. And they had a lot of entertainment for us, but what I remember being very difficult for me, and I would expect for some others too, was that most of us were very busy in our lives. Like, for instance, at this time I was working on my master's degree, taking night classes. I was teaching and coaching at a junior high and coaching at Seattle Pacific. So I didn't have a lot of time at home. I was working out in the morning before it got light and working out in the dark and at Seattle Pacific, because women didn't have the facilities. I was coaching the women's basketball and volleyball team at 6 in the morning, so you can guess what time I did my early runs, you know. So when you get into a village where there isn't a lot to do and your room is that small, and you're used to being so busy you could hardly fit your running in, it's very hard to be in an environment where what did you do with yourself, you know? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can imagine.
You're used to having all these responsibilities that keep you busy all the time, and now you're sitting in there pretty much thinking about how you feel and if you're going to run well and being nervous and whatnot. So I think emotionally, the village wasn't a good experience for me. Los Alamos had been much better because we were in an area where we could run all we wanted to in beautiful places, and they had things for us to do, like we could go to the movies as much as we wanted, and we could just, people were providing things, and it was just a really neat outdoor environment in the mountains. Mm. So the village was, I don't know, emotionally it was a tough time. I feel like I probably should have run better than I did, although in my race, I was somebody did trip me, and I think a lot of this comes down also to those of us who were not used to running close to other bodies or having people in our races, you know, like probably what you heard about Mary Decker and the 84 Olympics, that kind of thing with her and Zillabud. You know, for women, we just weren't used to having that. And so when somebody pushed me and I fell down and got up again, I didn't go all the way down. I just tripped and went down on one hand, but I lost my rhythm. And I think I went into the race with the fastest time of anybody in that race. And I thought I had a chance at least to get a medal. But I didn't get a medal. I was fifth. So it was disappointing. But on the other hand, I was very excited for Madeline. We were good friends, and for her to set a record and to win the race, to me, that was very gratifying. And it isn't like I went home, you know, wishing I hadn't been there or anything. It was very exciting. It's hard to put that into words. It's the kind of thing where everything that had built up, the years I had spent getting ready, you know, hoping to be there and to do something, I guess the negative part was I felt like I had let people down because I didn't run as well as it wasn't my best time. It wasn't a great race. And I guess I hope I learned some things that have helped me to be a better coach since then.
Mm-hmm. Well, you raise a lot of different issues that are really interesting that we can go back and touch on. Just looking back on the teammates you were with there, competing with, did you become particularly close with anyone on the team, would you say?
Well, those of us who ran the 800, like with Madeline and Francie, Madeline and I are still very close. We share a spiritual bond as well as an athletic bond, and we're still involved in some things together that have resulted from the Olympics. Our paths cross occasionally, and yeah, we are really close friends. And Francie Crocker Johnson, she and I have been close friends. We haven't been in touch the last 2 years, I guess, but yeah, I've made a lot of friends. Probably the best friend, the closest friend, was Ron Whitney, who was a 400-meter hurdler. I got to know Ron and his wife, and remained good friends with both of them. And I'd say out of all my friends, Ron's probably a person who's had a big influence on me. He was real support as far as, you know, helping me to believe that being a woman in sport was a good thing. And, you know, just enjoying our athletic, what we had in common athletically and values. And that's probably my closest friend that I have maintained a relationship with right up till, you know, right now still.
Okay. Well, you discussed earlier the training in Los Alamos for the high altitude.
Yeah.
And certainly the high altitude in Mexico City was certainly something that caught the attention of a lot of the athletes that they had to prepare for. So by the time you got to Mexico City to compete, do you think those training methods that you had gone through and going to Los Alamos, did that pay off? Did you feel comfortable in Mexico City?
I'm sure it paid off. I mean, we were led to believe that we were, you know, we needed to be up there. I had the opportunity to be at altitude for a long time. I had a good coach who I think was an asset. For me, it was hard to be in Mexico City without my coach, maybe. Well, he was there, but, you know, he was watching. But because of the village situation, I don't think I was a person who was totally dependent on my coach. I mean, he coached for independence. But still, your first Olympics is a tough thing. And, I think I was pretty well prepared physically. I probably was better prepared, you know, if there had been a 5K, I probably would have been better prepared for that because I did a lot of over distance. But we had adequate time, and in our day, we had time for good workouts. As I look back on it, though, I think that we didn't have the psychological assistance that we probably could have used. Like now, you know, we have psychologists, counselors who go along. Madeline's coach was actually the coach, Alex Ferenzi. But I don't think anybody really helped us to feel like we should talk about our nervousness or the kind of things that were going on inside ourselves, that maybe the kind of support that, as an Olympic coach myself and a manager and having been the coach for quite a few cross-country and track teams, you know, what I see now is provided and what I would hope that I provide. You know, things are different now. They're a lot better, and I think it's because we went through these experiences and we saw, you know, what would help. But at that time, I don't think I was emotionally where I could have been to give my absolute best.
Okay.
But physically, yeah, I was prepared physically.
Okay. Did you attend the opening or closing ceremonies? And if so, could you describe just your recollection and thoughts on that?
Yes, I did. You know what I remember most of all was Mickey King. Have you interviewed her yet?
No, I haven't.
Well, Mickey King seemed to know the leadership of the USOC, and she was a diver. Do you know who she is?
No, I haven't come across her yet.
Well, she was also in the military.
Okay.
And but she was a very likable person, so I think they leaned heavily on her to get us, you know, in the practice to be lined up to march in and all this stuff. And so Mickey was a person that, you know, was really I think, helpful to a lot of us. And to this day, we've remained friends, too. But I remember, you know, about, because I was short, I was near the front, which was really nice. And it was a wonderful experience. I mean, sure, we did have to stand around a long time. I know some athletes today probably don't want to do that. But I think that being a part of opening and closing ceremonies is really important. To gain everything that's available from the Olympics. Your race, sure, that's why you're there, but there's just so much more that you remember and that has is meaningful in your life and helps you to be a person that has a lot more to give to others if you take part in these things.
Mm-hmm.
So the opening ceremonies to me was really neat. Seeing all the countries go in and, you know, even at that time, because it was a Spanish-speaking country, we were Estados Unidos, so we were marching in earlier, you know, because when we're United States, we march in late because they're alphabetical. But still, you know, seeing all the other countries and their uniforms, and I just can't even express to you, you know, how amazing this is, getting to share this with your teammates and with other people from other sports in our country. Closing ceremonies was neat too. They had wanted it to be kind of short and sweet and not the same as opening ceremonies. I think they were just going to have a few people go out there, but has anybody else talked to you about this? There was a moat, but the Australians were probably the leaders of the pack in all this, and the United States was probably right along with them. But we found ways for the athletes to go ahead and all go out on the field at closing ceremonies, and that was really wonderful. Opening ceremonies is really organized. You know, you march in, you carry your purse the way you're supposed to carry it, you don't take pictures when you're not supposed to. But closing ceremonies is just when all the teams mix together, and it's a real meeting of bringing the world together as one. Very joyful.
Mm.
Also, in the opening ceremonies, I don't know if this is the kind of thing you want to hear, but, you know, some of the things you learn. At that time, the blacks all had big afros. And when you're standing out there on the field and they release the doves, you know, these doves are pigeons that have been in little boxes for some time. And so they're flying all around over your heads, pooping on everybody's hair. And so when we went back for the 72 Olympics, I think a lot of people took a big sheets of plastic that they held over their heads, because afros are really hard to clean out when they have pigeon poop in them. So that's just one little sidelight.
Well,
of course, the other thing at the Olympics, you know, that was a very weighed heavily on our mind was the business about the black glove thing and what all went on as far as that went. And I think when we were talking about if we should refuse to participate, I didn't really know where I stood on that. I didn't know what I was going to do. I'm really glad that we didn't have to make that decision. But I think if we had to make the decision, that I would have gone with the blacks.
So prior to competing, was there a lot of discussion among the athletes as far as some kind of a protest or?
Yes,
just...
there was.
Okay.
And being young and new and, you know, not an insider on all this, I wasn't, like, directly involved, but there were some meetings, and we all knew that, you know, this could very easily come to a boycott. And this was, it was important to me. But I'm really glad it worked out the way it did, and even with what happened on the victory stand with those athletes from the 200. I think at that time it was like they had done something awful. But, you know, when our 68 Olympic team met, we met in San Jose. Our team had a gathering. And at that time you could see that things had really turned around. You know, now there are statues to honor those people down there in San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all know that it was the right thing to do, and it was done in a respectful manner, and it got the attention of the world in a way that some of us feel like it had to be done because other ways weren't working.
Sure. So a couple of things you said have stood out to me. When you said there, prior to the competition, there was already discussions about possibly what could take place as a form of protest. Now, was that discussions just among the athletes, or were coaches and Olympic officials involved with that?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm sure they knew about it. Probably, you know, there are going to be a lot of people that you interview who are going to know more about it. So, you know, I'm probably not a good person to talk to more specifically about it, but I wouldn't want you to think that it wasn't on my mind or my heart, and that it wasn't just probably even more important to me than my own race.
Mm.
Race was more important to me than my own competition.
Well, that's very interesting. So, just looking back on that, on the whole Black Power salute, that, I mean, really is one of the most memorable times or events in Olympic history. Did, when it occurred, when you were there, did you realize the significance of it then, or did it take many, many years for it to become apparent?
I think we realized it was very significant, but I think that, you know, as you look back on something, you always get a broader view and a different view, and also society, I think that, you know, what's come later on from that is a very different view. At the time, that, you know, it was just like, this is not the place for politics. But, you know, how can you say that? I mean, you look at Olympics, you know, already we were in a cage because, you know, the security issues and what was going on in Mexico City at that time. So this wasn't like an isolated instance of politics, was it?
Mm.
And, you know, there might have been a better way to do it, but I don't think any of us looking back can think of what that would have been.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I mean, that was certainly a memorable, or something that was symbolic, that's still associated with 68.
I hope you get the chance to talk to Lee and John and these guys. I hope you do, because I think that, you know, especially after all these years, to talk to them will be really interesting to get the viewpoint, if they can think of where they were then and where they are now. I think it would be really, this was, out of all the things that have happened at other Olympics and those who have boycotted for this, that, and the other reason, I think that this one, at least in our country, this is a very significant thing. And for athletes to be willing to give up that kind of thing, you know, their own competition, you know, I believe they would have if it had come to that. I believe we would have given it up. And, you know, some things are more important than your own personal little goals.
Mm-hmm. All right. No, that's terrific just to hear just all that went into that. But something else that was taking place, of course, during the 68 games was the Cold War. So can you comment just how the Cold War, did that impact your experience? Did you have interaction with members of the Soviet bloc? Just what do you recall from that aspect, you know, just during that time?
Well, I don't recall a lot about how that affected us in the village. But what I do remember was, you know, some of the Iron Curtain athletes, especially, I forgot her name now, but a gymnast who was very outstanding. And I think it was the first time I had really been around athletes from other sports. But I wish I could remember her name. But a really outstanding gymnast from the Iron Curtain countries was prominent. And the other thing, of course, that the men's basketball team, you know about that.
Mm-hmm.
So getting to go to one of those basketball games, the last one, where they really did pull it off.
Doris, you still there? Doris? Okay, we're going to pause right here. Our phone connection has, we've been disconnected. Okay, we'll just get right back into it. So, looking back on the 68 games, what would you say was the most meaningful part of your experience there in Mexico City?
I think just You know, I've thought about this one. It's really hard for me to say. It's just, rather than a few specifics, I mean, there's specifics like the good friendships, getting to see things that I'd never seen before, like, you know, see the pyramids of the sun, the pyramids of the moon. Afterwards, I got to take a trip with a small group of athletes to Chile, and I did really well there. It was really good. In fact, they hadn't had rain for a few years, and I told them when I ran it was going to rain, and it did. Anyway, there's those little things, you know, with people and so forth that were important. Just the whole idea of being in the village and the security situation, being around so many people of excellence. I think more the overall view of it is just the whole thing. It's hard to describe, to see so many excellent things going on. Like, you know, I got to see that triple jump or the long jump world record. You know, when you see things like this that are so amazing,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's hard for me to just focus in on one thing. I guess though, it's tried to say, you know, getting to travel and the people you meet, the places you go. But that really is, even though it's trite, that really is it. And it's more, I think even if I had run better, if I had had a medal or something, I don't think that would be the thing that I would say would have been the most important. The most important would have just been the life experience that helps you to grow into somebody that you weren't before you were there.
Mm-hmm.
And the influence of amazing people of excellence, you know, when you're allowed to surround yourself with people who can lift you up and where you can also be someone who lifts others up, hopefully to be a person who is a better contributor to society because you've been through the experience. Because I didn't run well, I'm thinking every night when I went to bed for 4 years, you know, I'm going to make sure that I don't, you know, don't have something like this happen again. You know, that's the painful side of it. But, you know, the only way that you grow or change or move on from where you are is to go through hard things. You don't ever, easy things don't necessarily bring you to be a different person than what you were. And it's really what you make of the situation. And so I believe that being able to go to the Olympics was a huge gift, and it gave me a lot of opportunities that I hope I chose the right direction from those opportunities. So as a private person, you know, that's what I would say. I hope that I've taken the opportunities that were afforded me and used those to give back. But just the pageantry of the whole thing, you know, being around that environment, the excellence, I guess we all know that nobody does exciting, amazing things of worth because it's easy. You do it because of, in spite of, not because of. And that kind of a rarefied atmosphere where everyone has a story and, you know, they're just not people who are privileged and it just happens easily for them, but it's hard to describe. But this is where excellence comes from, and to be around, you know, a long period of time of nothing but excellence is that rarefied atmosphere is something that some of us can't put into words.
Well, that's understandable. Something else just to go back on, in the 68 games, it's also noted just as the first games where athletes were deliberately tested for performance-enhancing drugs. Do you recall any of that? I mean, did that stand out to you competing there?
Well, I think the people who were tested were people who got medals and whatnot, so I don't recall that I was tested. But probably the testing that was more on the minds of some of us, especially if you were an event that wasn't necessarily likely to have been, you know, probably Diana Ball was a big thing then. It was for throwers mainly. The thing that was harder, I think, or more interesting, would have been the gender tests. That was a big deal at that time. And I wasn't bothered by it. I think at that time they were scraping our mouths, so it wasn't a big deal, or pulling hairs out of our head. But quite a lot was made of that, because there had been some people, apparently, in previous competitions who were men posing as women. So that was probably a bigger deal. And then they did, they also did some anatomical studies with us, just to see what our bodies were like, to see, you know, to see what great athletes, how they look different than other people or something like that. So that was interesting, and I was happy to be a part of that because I was a physical education teacher and my major was in a biological area. So both that and the sex testing were fine, and again, I wasn't really a part of the other. Probably the people that I spent time with, that I trained with, were like with Ron Whitney and some guys from the that track club, Bill Toomey and those people. And so I knew that Bill and a couple other guys had, Ron, they had, you know, they had been exposed to drugs, and it was like, it didn't seem to make a difference to Ron, you know, he wasn't going to use them. But at that time, I don't think it was, it wasn't so much a negative thing as far as, well, I think we were looking more at health. What would this do to your health? I don't think there was such a stigma about using drugs because it would give you an advantage. And again, that, I'm looking at it from a, you know, from the angle of a more of a distance runner and someone who wasn't around people who were using the drugs to gain an advantage. So I'm probably not the best person to discuss that with. Later on, that wouldn't have been my case because I was an Olympic coach in 84, and, you know, through that time as a coach, I did become quite aware and of the whole situation and what was involved. But at the 68 games, I wasn't that much tuned into it.
Okay. So after the Olympics were over, what kind of reception did you get when you returned home, and did you have any, I guess, downtime, or did you go directly back to training, go back to work, go back to school? What was it like for you right after the games?
Well, when I got home, it, you know, we were well into the beginning of school, and I was teaching junior high, and let's see, I guess the effect that had on me was, in those days, people liked to teach 7th and 9th grade, but 8th graders were tough, so when I got back, I got all the 8th graders. The kids I coached were and taught were excited about what I had done. No one ever made me feel like, you know, how come you didn't get a medal? I think that all came from within myself. So, yeah, returning home and having this school, the school that I taught at, they were okay with it. They had a substitute for me, and I didn't lose my job or anything. But, you know, at that time, another issue that was pretty important to us was amateurism. And I think all of us who are school teachers were kind of in the same boat. Like, the reason I was teaching in that junior high was because the junior high I had originally been teaching in, they told me I either had to quit teaching or quit running because there were just too many conflicts. If you were on a track meet on a Saturday, it probably was on television on a weekday, not live. And so the principal said, how do you think people are going to be voting for levies if they see their teachers are running around doing these childish things? And sometimes I would run to school, and I had to arrive at school in a dress, so I'd have to stop at one of my students' houses, put my dress on, go into school, go down, change into the clothes I wore to teach PE. You know, there were so many ridiculous things like this. But for women, it was probably worse. But for guys, it was the same thing. I mean, I'm sure that there were many of us who didn't have the jobs we would have had. And when I started coaching and teaching at Seattle Pacific, I think I mentioned that, you know, the women had to train for their sport early in the morning because the men had the gym during the reasonable hours. So women did have, you know, at that time, there were things now we would probably just get ourselves a lawyer and be done with that kind of stuff. But especially for amateurism at that time, you couldn't coach. So any coaching that I did, it was the same with other people, the coaching we did had to be unpaid because if we were paid to coach, we wouldn't be amateurs. And that was probably the biggest deal, the hardest part for athletes at that time. There was no money. So you were supporting yourself in other ways. I wasn't one living out of the trunk of my car like some of the guys. I'm sure you've heard about this. But still, you know, when you're working long, hard days, like I said, running in the morning when it was dark and in the night when it was dark because you were working during the day, you know, that made your experience really more meaningful to you because you had to give so much to have the experience. And, you know, the more you put into something, the more you get out of it. And I feel that's really true. I would never regret that I did it or think, you know, it was, the situation was so desperate. In a way, it was. But, you know, between what happened in my marriage and what happened with working a lot, and I really look back and wonder, now I could never do that kind of thing and be able to run at all. And my story isn't unique. I'm sure other people have worse ones. So when you look and see the results of what people did in the Olympics, from our country anyway at that time, not the Soviet bloc, because they already were professionals, that issue is one I think that there's a big story to be told.
Mm. All right. As you said, you went on and were coaching Olympic athletes later on, and so you have not just an experience as an athlete, but also as a coach. So now that you've had all these years to reflect on the 68 games and just your whole Olympic experience, what's one piece of advice you would give to an Olympic hopeful today as they're trying to, I guess, reach that level of competition that you were at?
Let's see. What did I write about that? Having trouble reading my notes. They don't even make sense to me now. Let's see. Well, one thing I could say is I think that looking back, you know that you need, like, separating the Olympics out from other parts of goals, you know, to have that goal to go to the Olympics, which was really an important goal in my sport for me because we didn't have world championships or anything like that at that time. It was pretty much every 4 years. That was about it. Mm. There were the Pan Am Games every 2 years, but it was pretty much the Olympics. You didn't go to Europe and spend the summer running around. We had a few dual meets. So the Olympics was a big goal. And to have a goal like that, that you focused on, you know, that was the driving force and that was the focal point. But the journey is always more important than the destination because the journey is really what's your life. And that's really where the people you spend your time with, the things that happen to you. So I guess I would just really encourage people to enjoy that journey and not be so focused on something like the Olympics or where they're, you know, whatever their goal is in their sport, not to be so focused on that at the expense of enjoying the journey. I think I could have enjoyed the Olympics more if I had learned how to do it, but in my case, because I didn't ever have that opportunity, it was like training was the good part of the day, you know. There were so many other pressures. So, I would encourage people to really enjoy their journey while keeping focused on the destination, because without that goal, you're not going to have that kind of journey. You're not going to, when you have that thing that you put everything into, that's what gives you the journey. But the journey is probably more important than the destination.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That sounds like some great advice there.
Along the way, I mean, like in my case, it gave me a life. It gave me the coaching opportunities that I had, you know, both professionally and, I guess being an Olympic coach is a professional too. Those kind of things, though, just they take you to places that you could never go. Giving yourself to the excellence, doing the best that you can do, takes you places both inside yourself and in the world that you would never go otherwise. And I could spend all day telling you about the experiences I've had because I did give myself fully to my goal. I think I didn't ever put it first, though. I mean, in a way, Ralph, can you call the dog?
I've got to go.
Where are you going?
To the American Legion.
Okay. Okay. Anyway, running has given me so many other experiences that have been valuable that no matter what you put into it, it's worth it. It's worth the broken bones. It's worth the heartache when you don't make a team that you wanted to make. All those things that happen along the way. When you don't improve, when you think you should. All of those kind of hardships. It's worth it. I think you could go to extremes so that it wouldn't be. If you shut everything out, if you don't care about other people, if you don't take time for other people or something like that. But if you prioritize your athletics so that you give up the right things to be good, athletics is what gives you a life. And I don't mean a living. Nowadays, it can give you a living, too. And I didn't have to worry about that part because running didn't give me a living. It didn't give me money. I can't even remember. I think one time I got a plane ticket somewhere or something like that, but no money ever. So because you know we were amateurs, but and I didn't take anything under the table. But the difference between making a living and making a life are very different. And giving yourself to a goal like being the best you can, using what God gave you to the best of your ability, gives you opportunities to give back. I guess that would be the best I could put it. That's what I would want to pass on to others. Take your opportunities and use them in a way where you do have something to give back to others, and that's going to be the highlight. But you only have those opportunities if you give your best to your sport.
Okay. No, that's a great outlook. Well, just, you know, again, looking back on the 68 team, what does the preservation of the 1968 U.S. team legacy mean to you?
Well, it really means a lot to me because I think, first of all, because of the what was going on with the Cold War, what was going on with the black issue, what was going on with amateurism, I guess you just say values. There's just so many values there. And the personal values are also national values, and they're the values of what the Olympics is all about. The Olympics is probably the one thing that brings the world together as nothing else can do. I think music can do it in a way, but actually the Olympic Games, you know, what Pierre designed these things to do, even though there have been problems with it, being a part of something that really does bring the world together and having a personal part in that, I think each of us do, because the whole is only made up of the sum of each of us individually. And for the most part, people on that level are giving, you know, 100% to it, not just for their medal or their money, but for not going into it with the idea, oh, yeah, boy, I'm a part of history here, but the idea that you do realize inside yourself that you are an ambassador of the Olympics, and the Olympics has the opportunity to make a huge difference in the world. So we're important pieces of the puzzle, and that's an amazing feeling.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, I could tell you a couple of things, for instance, with me that the Olympics made a difference with. I didn't take money, and you know, in ways, after the Olympics, there were things we could have done. A shoe company did offer me things, and I didn't do it. And I passed up a lot of opportunities where others took them. I was invited to run in Europe, and my way would have been paid, and they would have given me money, and I was told that I would be banned from amateur competition if I did that by our federation. And so I paid my own, took out a loan, and went on my own. And some of these things might be stupid. Other people didn't do this. But I think for me, it's who I am and what I think was right for me. And I think because of this, and because I really did want to give back, when Nikki King was, after the 72 Olympics, she was the person that was kind of the head athlete representative from the USOC, and she brought together a group of athletes who were members of the USOC, and I was the representative from track and field. And even though I didn't have a medal, I think, you know, because I had given my best and made good friends, and you know, I somehow had the opportunity to be in a position where I was able to be this representative. That was important on the USOC, and then in our sport, the IAAF is the Track and Field International Sport governing body. I was the first woman to be on a committee there. The road running, it was a cross-country committee, which later on became the Road Running and Cross-Country Committee. I was able to be on that committee, and while there were many people who fought for longer races for women, I was in a unique position to represent that part of it. And so, you know, I'm not just saying, oh, I'm gloating because we got to have longer races due to us, but I think those of us who really put ourselves into it at that time, we did make a difference. Because now women do have these longer races, and other sports have events. Like just recently, the women gained—I don't know what it's called. it's a skiing event. You know, the trick-type skiing that wasn't in the Olympics for women that's just been put into the next one. So we did have a part in this, and then you know also. Being able to be an Olympic coach, these are the kind of things that came to me and gave me an opportunity to serve. And I think that almost every athlete that you would talk to would be able to tell you things like this that came to them where, you know, not necessarily, these are not things that you made money at or gained great prestige at. For instance, with me, I resigned from the committee as soon as I felt like I had less to offer than other people. I didn't just stay on that committee for my whole life like, you know, we really could have. But to me, I get my greatest joy out of contributing in ways that have meaning for the athletes to follow. And I think you'd find those kind of goals with other people, too.
That's great to hear. I know we've touched on a lot of different topics, but is there anything else before we wrap up that you think is important or that you'd like to share with us today?
I'm really thankful that there's going to be the 1968 Olympic team legacy. To me, this is really an amazing, outstanding thing, and I'm just excited to be able to be a part of it, and I want to support this in any way I can. I think that each Olympics in itself is unique and has a great legacy in different ways, but I think the 68 was a real pivotal year in our country and in the world in a lot of ways, and if we're willing to give each of us to give what we can toward this and for what's happening from your end of it, this is an amazing thing. So I just want to commend you people for this, and I hope you're able to get the cooperation of a lot of athletes who can speak a lot better than I can.
Now, Doris, you have done terrifically, and believe me, it's our pleasure. And I mean, we feel very privileged to be in this role, and just to hear everyone's story. Everyone has such a different story and perspective, and it's fascinating, and I think so many people are going to benefit from this in the future moving forward. So
yeah, are you getting good cooperation from a lot of athletes?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We started off a little bit slow, but now we got a lot of athletes coming on board. So it's just the hardest part is really just finding time in everyone's schedule to sit down with them to record such a history. But once we do, it's a very interesting conversation, and the recollections. I mean, just all the data we're getting from this oral history approach, it's really rich, and so I think a lot of people many years down the road will be able to use it. So
One other thing, I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, you know, the managers and the coaches that we had on the 68 Olympics and around that time period, they gave so much, and we appreciated them, but I don't know if we ever let them know, or, you know, if I would hope that with what's, you know, in the interviewing of athletes, I don't know if it, Alex Ferenczi, Madeline's coach, he is still alive. I spoke with him a couple months ago. And Ed Temple, who was very prominent at that time, is still alive. But I think that our managers, I don't know if they're, Marilyn, I can't even think of her last name now, our manager, I think she's still alive. But You know, these people, it's going to be now or never speaking to them and getting their angle on things, and probably as much as the athletes, you know, what you hear from them would be important too.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and I hope we get that chance. That would be great.
Yeah.
But, well, if there's not...
It's going to have to be done soon because these people are really close to the edge.
Okay. well, if there's nothing else that you'd like to share on this, we can go ahead and end the recording now. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, this is Brennan Berg. We're back with Doris Brown Heritage, and we're just going to touch on a few additional topics that we realized we need to discuss. But Doris, just in your personal life, I guess, what impact did the 68 Olympic team, or making the team, how did people close to you react, or how did they support you during that time?
I had really great support from my coach, people in our community. The one problem about it for me was probably something that was common to women at that time. I was married to an athlete, and probably he had greater Olympic dreams than I did, but like most male college athletes at that time, men had pretty good support in high school, junior high, college, as far as being runners. You know, there was a coach, there was a team, there was always something there for them. But then when they graduated, they didn't have that support. So my husband sat on the Davenport and talked about going to the Olympics, and I went out and trained by myself and did what I always did and qualified for the team. And I felt like, you know, this was a hard thing in our marriage. And I saw this in other people's marriages, too, where girls were married to guys who had... both have these kinds of ambitions. My husband told me, if you go, I'm going to divorce you. And he did. And probably it was for the best, because probably we shouldn't have been married anyway. If our communication was what it had been, what it should have been, this probably wouldn't have been the case. But I think it was pretty typical as far as women's roles in those days. And most husbands really didn't, that wasn't their view of a wife at that time. And so, yeah, I would just submit this as definitely a problem that was probably emotionally a big problem for me even while I was there, because I had too much time to think, and these are the kinds of things that your mind would go to. Mm. Didn't help my competition, and it was a problem, a sociological problem that was common at that time in history here in our country. Okay?
Okay, well, thank you very much for adding that to the interview. So we'll go ahead and pause recording again.